Kent Knutson thought that the church ought to say something about on the occasion of the bicentennial, and his suggestion was that we say something in context of the gospel, the American dream in the light of the gospel, or something like that, and that it be directed not toward the 200 years that have gone, but the 100 years, the next century, the third century that is upon us, or will be. And of course Kent got sick just about 3 days after the convention. In fact, he was sick at the time of the convention, though nobody knew that. We could see that he had a little difficulty with speech. Came a little ponderously, but nobody paid any attention to that. But then it was it wasn't long after the convention, just a week or two, that it was that he went to Rochester, and they were all perplexed because his speech seemed to disappear practically. He could hardly talk at all. And after a while, he couldn't talk at all. And then he developed some other symptoms. But it was this strange disease that had a long time before they diagnosed it. And then it was a disease that, as far as was known, was always fatal. It had no way of any hope. Well, he died in February or March, and then it fell to Dave Preuss to appoint a commission to carry this out, and a commission of 18 people were appointed, and among the 18, it was a good mix. There were two blacks. One was a PhD in oceanography from South Carolina, and one was a social worker, a director of social work activities in Los Angeles, and Mary Henry, who looked like Aunt Jemima and was as articulate, whether in the rough language of the streets or the pious language of the prayer meeting, she was articulate in either one. And then there was an American Indian from Atlanta, Georgia. I think I left a few copies of the manifesto on some chair back there. He was a successful person by our standards. He was in the television business and had a farm. And then we had a Latin American, a lawyer from Omaha. And we had two men in government, the governor of North Dakota, Arthur Link, and Al Quie, representative in Washington from Minnesota. And we had a business executive from California, a rancher from North Dakota, the editor or managing editor of the Fargo Forum, representing the press, Cal Olson. Richard Salzman from Washington, a PhD in the area of social structures, and some pastors, and not many, just a couple, three. But it was a very good mix across the way. A labor leader, and I've never worked with a group that was as articulate and as in effect as reflective as this group. We met together as a group of 18 four or five times across 2 years' time, and then there were meetings of subgroups to do some editorial work. Dorothy, there's a copy of the manifesto over there somewhere.
On your chair?
I think so. You see it?
Yeah.
And we had a lot of excellent meetings and hard work. And the question was, what do we give to the church? Do we give rather, let's say, something of 25 pages in length, for instance, or a few statements that could be nailed up on the church door, like Luther and his 95 Theses, or what? Well, we gradually decided that the principal document had better be a short one, and then any group that wants to deal with it extensively could get bibliographical resources to supplement the manifesto. And that's the way it was settled. Now, we're going to meet in August. We've gotten reactions from congregations and from clusters of congregations that have studied the document. And we're meeting in August to do some editorial work on it. The obvious omission in the document, and that's been called to our attention several times, is that we say hardly anything about the evangelistic task of the church, the task of proclamation, the task of winning converts or followers for the Lord. The document is directed almost entirely to the what does a Christian do in society, not what does the church do to win more Christians. So with that observation, now I'll make other observations as we go along. I'd like to read it. Grateful to God for his blessings to our country, we, the members of the American Lutheran Church, join in celebrating the bicentennial of the American Revolution. That's about the only statement we have and that could be stated well. It's a wonderful thing to celebrate. And, nor does it say that we're such a wonderful country. We, of course, have tried to stay away from any self-applause. Probably we've gone too far the other way. You can judge. Section 1, we declare that our loyalty to Jesus Christ takes precedence over any other loyalty. For us, the dream of the gospel comes before the American dream. We further declare our unshakable conviction that through allegiance to Christ and his vision for the human community, we can serve our country most profoundly and exercise the privilege of United States citizenship most effectively. That in a profound sense, loyalty to Christ would be the best way to be loyal to the country. Number 2, we repent for the ways we have strayed from this first loyalty. It was apparent almost right away that the American dream had a dark underside. The black man, the Indian, and later on other groups that came in didn't have a share in the dream. In fact, it was the Protestant white, really, who had the go-ahead sign as far as the dream was concerned. The Catholics suffered not persecution, but they weren't embraced with great fervor in the opening parts of the of our history. We repent for the occasions when we have faltered in the struggle for justice, liberation, and peace. But the times we have uncritically accepted the manipulation of economic, social, political, and religious power. For our extravagant consumption, while other members of the human family suffer hunger and need. We acknowledge that God's wrath is real and terrible. He has judged our nation. He will continue to judge us. And yet we know that God's final word is love. His ultimate will for all people is unity and peace. Number 3. As we begin our nation's third century, we declare anew our intent to live as Christian people who are free. Free from guilt for our sins and mistakes. Because we confess them and accept God's forgiving grace. free to face and deal with the tragic consequences of our national errors, because God is ever involved with us, and free to embrace the future with hope, because we trust in the promises of God. Number four, out of this freedom, we dream of a nation whose policies and life will declare to all. Now this is really the content of the manifesto. We celebrate our interdependence because the life and destiny of each person and each nation are tied to the whole of God's universe. This note came out again and again. This is, if we had a Declaration of Independence 200 years ago, we now must have a Declaration of Interdependence. We cherish all of nature as God's created handiwork entrusted to our care and keeping. This whole business of ecology and preservation of natural resources. We respect each person and affirm that every human being has infinite worth. We rejoice in the diversity among persons, which enriches and strengthens our communities. We condemn racism, sexism, and other forms of exploitation which fragment the human family. Now, there are other forms of exploitation. We affirm the family as it unites persons in bonds of mutual love and service. We require that all structures of society be shaped to serve genuine human needs. We view science and technology as means to a more abundant life for all, rather than as ends in themselves. We seek peaceable means for settling disputes among nations, among groups and individuals, and condemn actions and policies which provoke violence. We strive to end world hunger and population pressures. We welcome the continued separation of church and state, but deny the separation of religion from life. Number five, accepting these truths, we commit ourselves to shape and to share in a new American dream that will balance individual initiative with social conscience, private enterprise with public duty, competition with cooperation, ambition with compassion, pride with humility, national survival with service to the world, human knowledge with spiritual wisdom. We pledge our involvement in the social systems and structures so that they become more faithful to God's will for his world. Number five, six. Thus we seize with joy the challenge of reshaping our nation in its third century. We will join forces with the powerless, the poor, the lonely, the exploited, the deprived, and the rejected. We will resist any governmental, social, economic, or ideological force which would blunt justice or demean persons. We will work with any movement, party, or institution which will help us to respect all, care for all, and aim at freedom for all. We got a lot of flack on that one. Somebody said, would you join the Communist Party? Thus committed, we look to Jesus Christ for direction. Jesus and the prophets give us the vision of a world made new for a life of social justice and mercy, of reconciliation and peace, of promise and fulfillment. The Spirit gives us the power to do the deeds that faith, active in love, finds to do. Our hope is in God. And so, as pilgrim people of God, we step boldly and firmly into the third century. That word pilgrim people has the eschatological touch that we are on the way to something other than or greater than the eon in which we now live. Okay. Where would you like to dip your oar? We had a comment from a newspaper, a religious editor, saying that this is the most radical document that any Lutheran group has produced. And at long last, the Lutherans are getting out of this the kingdom on the right and the kingdom on the left, and facing the fact the kingdom on the left belongs to God too.
Mm-hmm. One thought I had it in the section 4, it says we condemn racism, sexism, other forms of exploitation which fragment human family. And I question the use of the word condemn there. Because it reminds me of, right off reminds me of scripture, says condemn not. And so I was thinking of a different type of word there that would explain the position, but not condemn.
Mm-hmm. Part of it has to do with, Christ says that they don't condemn those, you are condemned already.
Mm-hmm.
Thing, how to get that?
It's hard to get a handle on.
How about the word abhor?
Mm-hmm.
We abhor racism, sexism, and so on.
Mm-hmm. Sounds good.
So I think that you can condemn racism and sexism and the forms of exploitation without condemning the people.
Right.
And I think that in this sense, that's appropriate, because racism and sexism are deserved to be condemned. You know, I wish they'd go to hell and leave us alone, but of course they aren't going to.
Abhor is about our feelings, and condemn is something about the nature of this, of racism and sexism.
Yeah.
That's why you have to.
Mm-hmm.
That's why
those emotional overtones too.
See, there are other forms of exploitation, the economic one, sometimes that's more terrible than the racist one, as if the difference between those who have it and those who don't have it.
Mm-hmm.
Paul, I think there's a document over there if you want to look in.
I just copied it in the meeting.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Also in section 4, I have some question about the part where it says receive peaceable means for settling disputes among nations, groups, and individuals, and condemn actions and policies which provoke violence. I guess my experience in the Missouri Synod has been, what is violence and to what point must you go?
Mm-hmm.
I hassle with that. I understand why you do that, but there's such a fine line.
Yeah, what is violence, initially, we simply had a statement there against war, because I felt that the prospect of war, that is an atomic war in our day, if that comes off, you might as well throw this whole thing away. There aren't any values left, probably, because there won't be people left or anything left. And oftentimes, when I think of what we're doing with Russia and the United States and, I suppose, China too now, and a smaller nation, with arms, this race for arms, I think is the greatest madness that has ever taken hold of us. I suppose, would you say that a strike in, by a labor union is a thing of violence. Or was the thing that provoked the strike the violence? It, depending on how you define violence.
What about that one in six, work, no, the movement, working with any movement? And I know we don't just accept, I don't know, we don't belong to the American Council of Churches, do we, as a church?
No, we belong to the World Council.
To the World Council.
But we go through all kinds of back doors to be involved with the National Council, too.
The National Rep, yeah.
Mm-hmm. I remember one time somebody said, oh, why in the world don't we go through the front door? As long as we're sneaking in the back doors, and almost every division or department, the National Council, with unofficial participation. You know, that may have to be restated. I don't know.
You said you got a lot of flack on it. What kind of flack?
Well, somebody said, okay, you mean that you'll join with anybody, like the Communist Party, with the Christian Church, join the Communist Party in fighting for something good? Isn't there a limit to whom you will join? That I think was the question, you know, the question that was raised.
But it uses the word work rather than join, so.
Yes, that's right. Yeah.
It seems like it presupposes some sort of a thoughtfulness and care in choosing your organization, in the sense that you're going to review the whole organization, and not just because they've got this one idea that you're going to stick with, that you're going to go along with everything else they do.
I think maybe the upsetting part about the sentence is just the order of the words. The thing that a person would notice first is, we will work with any movement. And the problem is maybe they don't read to the end of the sentence.
Hmm.
If you use the word institution first,
mm-hmm.
I think movement and party tends to denote politics,
mm-hmm.
And that probably hits you first. But if we would work with any institution, and then.
But isn't that part of the purpose of the document, to actively take part in the left hand of God, to push political aspect,
mm-hmm.
of life? That was going to be my question, was, you know, this sounds like a statement of policy. I was wondering, is it?
Mm-hmm.
Like, is this what the church intends to live up to as a policy for the church? Is the church going to say, take political stands or make political endorsements, you know, for a candidate or for an issue?
Mm-hmm.
That would be a radical departure from the church.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what I'm wondering, if that's what is meant by this.
Well, but they also say, like, we welcome the continued separation of church and state.
Church and state, but then,
yeah. Yeah, but you could also switch that to non-participation political movement.
Yeah, but then that paragraph in six is a very strong,
mm-hmm.
strongly worded commitment to action,
mm-hmm.
taking part, to making decisions and announcing them.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I guess that question is, who does we include?
Seems like it's a real individual thing.
Yeah, that, and some of your flack would come on saying, you know,
mm-hmm.
on are you saying that the church is doing this, or I am doing this? If I don't, am I? Who's the we that I cease to be a part of if I don't go along with that point? Or
mm-hmm.
what is, you know, what is the reference of the we in this?
Yeah, I think that's ambivalent. I suppose when you say, how does the church get involved in the political process? Let's say the question of busing, that's been a moot one. Of value. Let's say that a congregation gets involved in in the busing problem, question, can you say that Trinity Lutheran Church is for busing because at a meeting of its congregation, 51% of its people voted in favor of busing? Can you then say that Trinity Lutheran Church is in favor of busing? Obviously, you can't. If I were among the 49%, I'd say you can't possibly say that about my church. And that, I think, is always the problem. When does the church, as the church, take a stand? In convention assembled, when there are 1,000 delegates that represent 5,000 congregations and they vote something, does that involve me in St. Anthony Park? That is, have they spoken for me? I guess probably I'd have to say that I lean rather heavily toward saying that the church, while it hasn't, you know, there is no more powerful lobby, if we were a lobby group, in the country than the church. If the church could be united, the Christian church could be united on something and bring its pressure to bear, it would be by all odds the most powerful lobby. But that isn't the way the church has functioned. I suppose at one time in the Middle Ages, the time of Innocent III, let's say, when the Pope was in effect church, if he spoke for the church, he was kind of the church. And he had all this power. So then the church was heavily involved in the political scene. Then you have, on the other hand, the monastic movement where you withdraw from the activity and are a group that deals with God and very indirectly with the body politic, somewhere in between there. I attended a meeting one time, years ago, at the Washington Cathedral, the College of Preachers connected with that, where the question that was discussed was Christianity and economic decisions. We had a good cross-section there, not a big group, and I got invited because on the program committee was a fellow who was in Eisenhower's staff and had been Undersecretary of Labor and was a fine Christian man, and he was involved with this. And through his invitation, I got involved. But Jim Pike was there. He was then Dean of the Cathedral in New York, St. John's, and Francis Sayer, the Dean of the Washington Cathedral, who was grandson of Woodrow Wilson, and Angus Dunn, the Episcopal bishop, and a couple others, but there weren't many pastors, many representing the church, but Victor Reuther, R-E-U-T-H-E-R, brother of Walter, was representing the auto workers, and the head of some big banking chain was there, and Senator Case from New Jersey, and well, anyway, the idea was to get us together as Christians to ask, how does Christianity or the church get into the economic decisions of the country? And finally, the answer really, well, it was a wonderful meeting because for the 3 days, despite the varied character, they belonged to different political parties, to economic interests and churches, the point was made the first night, all these are accidents of our existence. The thing that's the essential part of our existence is that we are followers of Jesus. We are Christians. It's quite an accident that Walter Reuther or Victor Reuther was in the labor movement. That was an accident of history. The significant thing was that he was a Christian. And this was a marvelous time together. And one man who was in charge of, economic mobilization in Eisenhower's staff, raised the question, how can the church get into my office? And he was a fine Christian layman, and he said, it's easy for me to be a disciple over in my in the church. He said, I'm a tither, I teach Sunday school, we have family prayers, and I do all of that. He was a fine Methodist layman. And he said, and of course, my pastor thinks I'm just a fine Christian man. But he said, there are no difficulties with the decisions that I make as a member of the congregation, but where it becomes rough to be a disciple is in my office. And how does the church get into my office and help me? Well, they pounded that around, and one said, well, would you like a battery of Methodist bishops who would study economics and tell you what to do? Well, everybody knew that wasn't the answer. And finally it was apparent the only way the church got into his office was in him. You know? There was no other way. That he became the church, that he became Christ in his office. But doesn't the church have some responsibility as a body of people? And that's what this document is getting at. It isn't saying, well, the main thing is come to Jesus. That's all we worry about. You come to Jesus. And that's the end of the matter. Well, that would be a document on evangelism. But it's not a document on evangelism. It says, we have come to Jesus. Now what? And that's what the document really is about. About how to get into the body politic.
I was wondering, did the group that you were with think that the structure should come from within the church, or would it be one of these things where you would go, we would maybe provide for other movements, say, you know, work with other movements? You know, I'm thinking of the World Council of Churches, and when they finally decided not to just sit and talk and then to act, that's when they got into trouble. I mean, serious trouble, serious criticism from the churches, say, involved, because the constituents may not even have known. You know, it's one thing to pass a resolution. It's another to give, say, $50,000 to a radical group in an inner city and then see the publicity thrown out, and you're part of that. Mm-hmm. And I was just curious if the group was thinking in terms of creating structure within the church, national church body, or just giving to other existing mm-hmm. structures.
I think both. For instance, let's get away from the national scene and get to a local scene. There's a local problem. And does the church, incensed or enraged by, let's say, the drug traffic or something that prevails in the high school, nobody seems to do anything about it, should this Lutheran congregation begin to do something about that? And put the heat on the enforcement officers and do things like that? And I think the document would say, yes, if nobody's doing it, you better do it. And enlist all the other movements and parties or institutions you can in dealing with a problem that's destructive. And
so that way you'd be kind of working from the bottom up instead of the down, top down, always.
Yeah. Yeah. Rather than developing a national American Lutheran Church Commission on controlling drugs or something.
Yeah, I think that's right.
Thank goodness. Got enough divisions up there already. It took me a whole year to learn them all.
How exactly do they intend to both end world hunger and population pressure?
Yeah.
That sounds like an impossibility.
Right. Well, I suppose it's simply that we've got to be aware of the relation between those two. And it doesn't say what are you for, is your chief concern to control world population so that therefore you push it over toward abortion and all kind of programs for curtailing population. Is that what we're saying? Not necessarily. But we're saying that there's a relation between world hunger and overpopulation that will have to be looked at seriously. I think in number five, when we examined what constituted the American dream or the values that have controlled our society in these 200 years, what personal qualities make up for a successful person? A person who has individual initiative, who has enterprise, who is competitive, who has ambition, who has some pride in achievement, and those things. Those have been the qualities that we admire. And they've been good qualities in developing a frontier, an expansive nation, a producing nation. Now, and we're not saying that these are bad, say that a person should not have individual initiative, he ought not to have any sense of enterprise except as a corporate enterprise, he ought not to be competitive, he ought not to have ambition, he ought not to have pride, and we shouldn't worry about national survival at all. We're not saying that. We're still saying that these are good qualities, but they'll have to be matched with some other qualities that we haven't as a nation bothered so much with up to this point. But some of these goals, we're frank to admit, are how do you get handles on them? For instance, we require that all structures of society be shaped to serve genuine human needs. This grew out of Richard Salzman's repeated concerns that in this huge industrialization that we have, and this rather massive way we do things, that the freedom of the individual gets gone, is lost somewhere. That what does a person, let's say he goes to work for DuPont, and DuPont in effect says, you serve us well and we'll take care of you, much like serfdom on a rather sophisticated high level. But does the person ever end up having any freedom anymore? Or is he simply tied in with the system? Moreover, all structures of society, particularly industrial structures, are obviously set out to produce a satisfactory result for the stockholder, which means the profit motive, instead of being much concerned about genuine human needs. How about the person on the assembly line? Is there some way, or even in a person on the executive level, is there any way for him to get into really free choices? Isn't he also locked in? And now to say, how are you going to do that? Well, I don't know. But the goal is there. Let's say that a person becomes the head of DuPont, and he really is worried about this. Without breaking up DuPont into 1,000 different smaller corporations, it might be possible for a policy that is embraced by the management, I suppose the ownership is so vast in the stock company that you can't get to the owner too well. Because the average person who holds stock, he's not worried much about who's being hurt, as long as his dividends are all right. He's too far removed. But maybe the person in power, if he's dominated by some of this, can do something.
Yeah, that came out in the men's retreat a few months ago. A fairly affluent community in St. Paul, Minnesota. And it was about 13 men, and there were at least two with very substantial positions in business. One happened to be a very successful stockbroker. And it was amazing to me, because we were sitting like this, and then they came out with these very questions. They didn't know what to do. They didn't know how to do or to bring their Christian life into their situations at work. And it was very frustrating for some of them. It was very frustrating to hear them talk about their jobs, and when they said they couldn't feel comfortable about kind of identifying themselves as Christian in their groups. But they were asking the question,
mm-hmm.
and maybe more of this statements like this mm-hmm. are needed.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think it's we're on the beam with seeing something that is very important, but I don't know how you emancipate the human being from the huge industrialization that we have. I was just reading an English economist, Schumacher, on this little book, "Small is Beautiful." And he calls attention to the fact that Gandhi, at one time, or when he was in power in India, pitted himself against the coming in to his country of this huge Western industrialization. That I remember when we were in India, and I saw them building these roads with a large number of women bearing on their heads baskets of small stones that they were dumping into the roadbed, and I thought, oh my gracious, why didn't we get Mr. Kaiser over here assembled here with these big bulldozers and get this done so that these nice women wouldn't have to do it? And I think that's probably a rather poor example, but Gandhi did not want Western industrialization. He wanted the small village, not the massive cities, and in the small village, small factories or small operations where a person had some visible result of his work, and where the owner or whoever had close contact with those who were working for him. But of course that means they couldn't produce the way we produce.
And you know, this reminds me of Chuck Colson's book. After he became a Christian, he was really surprised to discover other Christians in our United States government. And some of them were people that he'd worked with rather closely. And yet he had no knowledge of their being a Christian until he became one. And then some of them were his bitter enemies. And he realized that this barrier had to come down, that he had been offensive and that he was going to have to seek forgiveness and so on. And as soon as as his bitter enemy found out he had become a Christian, there was this feeling on both sides, and many wounds were healed. In fact, some of the people that couldn't stand him and he couldn't stand them, they became prayer brothers.
Yes, and now I thought of how one person dealt with this in a big corporation. I don't know what it was, either Data Control or Honeywell. So many people work for these corporations. And he was the top salesman in the district. It's Rich Parker. Mm-hmm. And he had gone on a trip with me with some kids, and he was telling me about his work. And he said, well, we turned down an offer to move. To move out and go into another district because they wanted him to use his skills somewhere else. And I said, well, and this was the second time he turned them down. And it's, if you read about corporations, you can turn them down once, twice, but the third time, they don't even ask you. In other words, then you stay and your mobility moving up into the corporation gets pretty much settled. But he made a really striking statement. He just said, well, that is not where my life is anymore. He said he saw what was happening to too many people this way. And his family came definitely first, which allowed him also to work with other kids instead of just not his just immediate family. And he gave time to the confirmation classes, which he was not good at all. But he just felt this was a priority. And he said people would ask him at work because he was top. It wasn't like he didn't have the choice.
Mm-hmm.
To go up.
Mm-hmm.
That's a small way, but I guess it's those mm-hmm. ways that seem to.
Mm-hmm.
I keep going back to that last statement under 4. We welcome the continued separation of church and state, but deny the separation of religion from life. That struck me the most in the whole document, and it still seems to be such a central part of what we see here. Ron and I were fortunate enough to be able to teach in a Christian day school for 4 years. And one of the most fabulous things about that was that you didn't have to separate religion from life in that situation.
Mm-hmm.
Religion wasn't just one course that was taught at one time or reserved only for Sunday mornings, but it was throughout the whole day and the whole experience with the children. And we always felt that we were at such an advantage in comparison to so many people whose life and work was so separated. And they were so, I mean, it wasn't only that we were teaching in a situation that allowed that. I mean, there were other people teaching in the school who had that separation in their lives anyway. I always tend to see things so much from an educational point of view, but if people could avoid drawing those separations in their lives to begin with, then they would be much freer to always incorporate their faith within all of their actions
mm-hmm.
and not feel that they had to leave it behind when they got to the office.
Mm-hmm.
So there certainly is a financial or economic factor of just being at your job and part of the operation or system of any business that makes money is that you don't get paid to share Christianity with people. I mean, you get paid to produce.
Yeah, but the thing is that your religious life is not just your evangelism.
So in that fact, it's a hard problem because what do you say to a person? Do you say, well, say to your boss, to heck with you, I'm going to talk about Christianity, or I'm going to share some Christian or religious ethic behavior in my job, or I'm going to lose my job. And I think that's a problem.
I'm not sure exactly what you're talking about, but what I'm talking about is not just talking about religion to people, but that that I am free to act as a Christian. And I would not stay in a job where I had to compromise my beliefs. I mean, I just wouldn't. And I feel very sorry for people who feel that they must.
Well, I mean, I've worked for different organizations, and There are certain organizations, if you want to belong to them, then you don't, you know, you don't share, let's say, Christian-type behaviors. The main thing is profit, and if you don't, you get fired. I work for, especially concrete companies. They're really rough this way. Work for a pre-stressed concrete company in Lincoln, Nebraska. Mm-hmm. People work there 12 hours a day, and they don't have maybe 50, 60 hours a week. And if they would share this kind of thing, they'd certainly lose their job. That's
you mean
if
you talked about religion, you'd lose your job?
Sure.
Well, yeah. See, I mean, I think I could live without that.
Well, really? But I mean, it seems as though, but I mean, even religious behavior or things, ethics.
You mean if you refuse to be dishonest, you would lose your job?
Sure, sure. That's part of it. So I think in some respects, a separation between a person's work, it has to be respected in some ways.
Yeah, see, I don't agree with that. I think if a person has to compromise what they believe in order to keep their job, they should get out of that job, because that job is going to kill them then.
I'm glad you brought up the concrete company. Because see, what happens if you know that dishonesty is going on? Now, in Coney Island, New York, they put up a whole concrete school structure. Whole thing was right there, sitting, everything, except you know, the windows and everything weren't in, but the concrete structure was. Well, they just couldn't bribe the inspector enough for the faulty concrete that was put in, that people knew they were putting in. So they had to tear the whole structure down. Now, what I'm saying is, well, what would have happened if you did stand up? Well, you may have lost your job, thank goodness, but what if they built that school and they had, you know, 1,000 kids in there? I mean, the responsibilities just go on when you think of that. And it's not even something hypothetical. Floors of buildings have crashed through and killed people. That's, in a sense, murder. I think Luther in his catechism just, he says, you think, you know, you're taking the Ten Commandments or something very lightly. Let's look at the big businessmen. They must have had businessmen then in the Middle Ages. I don't know how they worked it, but this is, you better look a little bit closer. And I guess...
Well, what I'm saying is, it's a little bit of a problem. Let's say
it's a
guy,
big problem.
There's a guy working at this concrete firm, and there's a problem with honesty, and he's making some money.
Sure.
And he has a wife and family that he believes in. So he believes in home and family, wife and family and religion. Now, what's he going to do? Is he going to stand up, lose his job, financially get way set back, or quit his job and not find another job, you know, go on welfare, and feel guilty because he's not working, because of the work ethic that you have to work. I mean, or should he just go to church and say, "Gee, I'm sorry"? You know,
I think if he has faith in God, he's going to quit his job and know that God's going to help him find another job.
Yeah, or not necessarily quit the job. I mean, first give the confrontation a chance. I mean, first go to your employer and say, you know, this is wrong. Or, you know, wait and see. This brings up another example, but people always look, some people look at Ron and me and say, well, you know, how can you just be so irresponsible? Here you are running off to this place where you're going to hardly earn any money, and you're going to have a child, and you barely have enough insurance to cover yourselves, and how can you take all these risks? And that's because we're also tied into this idea about security, and so convinced that if we don't follow these exact steps of, you know, you go to college and you get a good job and you get with a good company and you save your money and you buy your house and you get all your security, and then you're tied down with that security that you got. I think it's just terrible that people are imprisoned with that, and that they don't allow their faith to take action in their lives. And I think it's just terribly sad. And I think they become imprisoned by it and bitter with it and come to the point where they hate that wife and that child or children who force them to remain in a job that just demoralizes them. But I don't think that people have to be irresponsible and just see one little thing at their job that bugs them and say, well, I quit, you know, and I'm going to go to the church, and if the church doesn't support me, you know, I'll quit that too.
Yeah, I think this point of confrontation that you made, Lindsay, I think that's probably where the leaven comes. Mm-hmm. Certainly not in quitting the job, and certainly not in conforming to the lousy policies. But and the confrontation may not succeed in changing things, but it may. And I suppose that's where it happens.
But the confrontation might lead to his quitting the job or being dismissed.
Or, yeah, that's always a reality.
In which case, he shouldn't worry.
Yeah.
That's the point I'm trying to make.
Yeah.
You know, that inspector, they might have gotten him after a while.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they might have gotten his job after a while because I don't know it.
Mm-hmm.
But after all, he was a conscience, a conscience getting into the act somewhere.
Yeah, and the truth is, even, well, you take a practical, I don't know what, you know, the cases you're talking, I'm not sure how really bad it is or not, but you also have the legal option today. It's just amazing that you can also fight then once you're dismissed. I mean, there are, the law is for the people, essentially.
Mm-hmm.
I don't care how corrupt it gets, but if you can get the law to fight the very thing that, even though it may be bribery and everything else, but you have that chance. You have that option. It's hard, though.
Well,
sure.
I think there's money involved there, too. Don't you? In legal action and lawyers and this kind of thing?
Sure, there's money involved.
So the small guy who has a wife and family who loses out, so to speak, I mean, he can't go out and hire a full-time lawyer to handle whatever this...
Well, I'm just saying that's too hypothetical for me. You're talking about a guy who hasn't even taken a chance yet and hasn't lost his job, and he doesn't know how God's going to work in his life. He doesn't take any of those risks. I mean, I'm thinking of bond offer now. And the guy always says, well, what should I do? What should I do?
He's
sitting there.
Support for him or anything like that. You know, I mean, if you wait until it's all going to be safe and paid for you, I mean, obviously you're never going to do anything.
Well, there's something. I don't think it's that what would the Christian do in this situation? It doesn't have to, we don't have to cook up some kind of an dream thing in which jobs and families, if that happened, okay. But sometimes the person, I was working on a person that, say, inspecting stuff, hasn't felt guilty about the quality of stuff he's been putting out for maybe 10 years.
Mm-hmm.
Then you lay a little guilt on him, remind him of something, and that could be a step, and to see what happens. I was in a Ford factory making automobile regulators, and one night I decided to reject every part which, from my knowledge of the regulators, would break down, say, a year or two from leaving the factory, and I rejected about 80% of the parts that went through there. You know, and I had the guy, you know, the company down on my neck. You know, the guy that was the inspector and managed that line, too, which was kind of a, you know, negative inspector who was also responsible for the number of parts that go out. That's kind of true. But he came back and he says, I don't care. And he says, why aren't we getting any parts tonight? You know, and I said, well, tonight I thought I'd reject everything that is, you know, faulty. And he says, I don't care, you know, I don't care. We need numbers. You know, send them out. But after that, I said, okay, he wants numbers. The company wants 800 parts a night. The union won't let me do more than 400 parts a night.
Yeah.
You know, you're caught not just in one bind, you're caught in a number of binds. But I end up calibrating far more parts. I worked faster. I did everything that came down the line. I still rejected a great number of parts compared to the other calibrator. Left the company, got better parts. They got as many as they wanted. That was, you know, and I rejected the seriously, you know, faulty thing. And the guy, was that as important? No, maybe the fact that the guy may have felt guilty that night. That something went wrong in the line, and we had a lot of bad parts that night. That 80% of the things that night went out. And that may make a difference. That somebody said something. That somebody was watching what was happening in the line. That would, during a break, go down and ask him what he, you know, what's a good part, how do you tell how your machines work, and so forth. To where I could learn better about the piece and take more responsibility for the quality of the piece that went out of there. But part of the, I had to learn to become a really good calibrator so that they couldn't, you know, I mean, it was, they lost something if I lost. I was a burr in their side, but they would lose something if I wasn't there. Mm-hmm. And that might be in that sphere that you can without a tremendous conscience work for a company, you may work harder than you've ever worked before. Mm-hmm. But there really isn't any answer in terms of hypothetical situation. I think that you get in a situation like that, and I think to go talk to the people that you feel are responsible, but without attack, you know, without attacking them.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe they've just forgotten and so forth. But not many people are clearly doing something that they feel is evil.
Yeah.
And so that would affect the way that you go about dealing with that. I wondered, Al, on this thing, were there many real conservative people listening, I mean, on the committee? That wrote this?
Well, no, probably not, but I think yes, there were some, you know, Republicans who were uneasy about the general tone of this document, which seemed a bit revolutionary. In fact, we wanted to use the word revolution at one point, but that was thought unwise finally. And I think Al Kui would feel, well, everything that's here is right, but maybe we're not. I shouldn't say Al Kui, but let me say that several of them felt that it probably came off sounding a bit too radical. And of course, we're not applauding the country. And that's a bicentennial motif that we thought somebody else would take care of. And the question, how does the church, in quotation marks, do this? Is it through the individual as the leaven, or is it at times through the marshaling of a sort of the corporate pressure of the church? And of course, there's a place at times, I would think, for the corporate pressure to rise too. In this matter of abortion, you have the Bishop Per Lunding from Norway marshaling the church as the church to say something about this. And since the government didn't, the parliament didn't seem to heed what the church was saying, he resigned his bishopric as a kind of protest that he thought would sort of shake the country a bit. But it's pretty difficult to get, you know, Karl Reuss's office turns out a lot of things about resource matter for us to study on what do you do with these various social issues. But it's always a study document.
Mm-hmm.
It's not, even if it's passed or approved or accepted by a national convention, it's accepted as a study document to be referred to the congregations. The national church body isn't likely to. Well, I suppose they could pass a unanimous resolution against sin, but that's about as far as you can get.
Better not be fine. I reading this, like the section 4 and 5, I was not, that say a liberal would look at those two sections and not, and who had no, it wasn't a Christian, could look at those sections and say that if a person didn't agree with that, because they're stupid, they're not there on the
point mm-hmm.
in much of this.
Yeah.
That this is sort of, you know, I wonder how much slack you have from, well, yeah, those are, these are opinions, in a sense.
Yeah.
And again, who are you saying we is?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that may be a question that will appear, or will surface in Washington, D.C. when we meet in October, when the church meets in October. Does the church want to say it was want to be identified with a we? And probably someone will say, no, we don't want the church to say this. So we'll accept it as a document produced by 18 people and refer it to the congregations for their attention and study. That may be the way it'll be carried out. I was the only time I got a lot of letters from the constituency, as it were, while I was president of the seminary, it was in 1960. I occasionally get a letter from somebody saying, well, I hear the professor so-and-so is teaching so-and-so, but rarely. It's so rare that I never even worried about it. But in 1960, when Nixon and Kennedy were running against each other, and four of our professors joined professors of other theological seminaries, Lutheran theological seminaries, in endorsing Kennedy. And these four, and it was Quanbeck and Arndt Halvorsen and Kent Knutson, I think, and Roy Harrisville. And they all were, you know, I thought it a bit naive, I suppose, but they kind of concluded that this would probably go to a nice letter to Kennedy saying that the Lutherans liked him. But it hit the Associated Press and the United Press 2 days before the election and got the front coverage in the Minneapolis Tribune and the Fargo Forum and the Sioux Falls Argus Leader and all these here. Places. Lutheran theological professors endorse Kennedy. I got a stack of mail like that. What business did professors or pastors have of getting into politics at all? And
can you control your staff any better than
yeah, that's right. And I they said, imagine that any intelligent Lutheran would turn the country over to the Pope and think of Luther squirming in his grave. Oh, and the idea was that, well, they all said they ought to be fired, and I didn't answer any letters because I couldn't write and say, well, I'm sorry that they blundered and were so naive, and I agree they shouldn't get messed up in politics. I could say any of those things and it wouldn't be enough. I'd have to say they had sinned and they ought to be fired. That was about it. Because they had, the church, through its pastor or professor, had meddled in politics. That was the whole point, really. And it was interesting to contemplate that afterwards. I said it. I told the fellows, I said, you made a mistake because you should have had two plumbers in there so that the headline would have said, Lutheran professors and plumbers and Doris Kennedy, and that would have made a difference. Then I said, okay, if the church or the pastor or the professor shouldn't mess in politics, okay, who's left to mess in politics? The school teacher? No, he's serving a mixed constituency after all. He's being supported by the Republicans and the Democrats together. He better not do anything or he might lose his job. My father was had a general merchandising store, and fortunately he could be a rock ribbed Republican because there was hardly a Democrat within 20 miles of this place in South Dakota. But supposing half of his customers were Democrats and half Republicans, he'd better not say anything about politics or he'd lose some of his customers. And you just go down the line, who's left? Who's left to take part in the political system if only the people are left whose interest in politics won't ruffle anybody, or it won't cost anything.
Maybe those bums on the Bowery, possibly not offend anyone.
But it, so that the idea that the church shouldn't meddle in politics is a very deep one, and I'm sure that a lot of people will say that this document does. You're not even saying anything about converting Christians. You know, converting people. And imagine addressing the church, addressing the nation and saying nothing about that. I think we ought to say something about it because it assumes that we're addressing people who are followers of Jesus and want to do his will. And here's a document to help them find or discover where the areas of hurt. So we did start out by having a section addressed to the church to remind the church of its task of evangelism or commitment, having people committed to the Lord, and then another section addressing more both the church and the nation to the issues of the third century. But we, I just felt we, just so much we can say in the document, and decided not to address ourselves to what was the obvious continuing task of the church to recruit the will of people for God. And,
will you add anything in terms of directions you can go with this?
Yes, that'll be already from a task force that's been put together with Chuck Lutz as its chairman. They have suggestions what you ought to do with this, and to the congregations, and that they ought, in the light of this, see if they could visualize what in their local situation they ought to be about. It seems to me that. How does the church deal with this? Now, in the 20 years I was in the parish ministry, I didn't preach on politics, that is, directly in any way. And we didn't have in our congregations any forums talking about issues, either. Mm-hmm. Now, it seems to me that that's where the church in the third century could embark on something that we haven't been preoccupied with much, and that that at least a number of people in the congregation could, in study groups or in forums, grapple with issues and try to clarify where the will of God may lie. I'm sure it's done one-to-one, but not as a congregational activity. We never did.
Not done as a clarifying the issues.
Pardon?
I mean,
just to clarify.
Well, yeah, I think the church in clarifying these is, I think one-to-one, you go with somebody who agrees with you. And that's and clarifying issues is something else again. It's really trying on the, you know, taking your opinion and inverting it and seeing what the other side is about, trying to come up with some new understanding. But I think that, I don't think that is done. That isn't done very much in the university either.
I think a Christian church could do it. I were a pastor today, I would certainly try to keep something like that going. When I think of the parishioners I've had, like in First Lutheran in Sioux Falls, I had the governor of the state as one of my parishioners. He was sitting in the pew, he was a bachelor, he was sitting alone in a pew every Sunday. Fine lawyer. And other leaders of industry. It wasn't a big city, of course. You didn't have General Motors and, you know, the big shots. But in every congregation, you have people who are whose discipleship is lived out there somewhere, where the issues are reflect some of this, and some great people. In this Washington meeting, it was Arthur Fleming who was in the Office of Defense Mobilization who raised the question: How does the church get into my office? He finally said, I guess there's no way that the church can get into my office, but I wish my pastor would understand, would feel, and other members would feel, that the crunch, the difficult part of my apostleship or discipleship is in my office. Mm-hmm. And he said, I've never even gotten that feeling from the pastor that he's bleeding with me or suffering with me.
Yeah.
And I thought back of that. In some small way, I think I succeeded because Nels Boe, the governor, we did get together at lunch and he talked about his problems in the state house and I'd ask questions. Why did you decide this way? And at least I gave him the feeling that I had some concern for. For the kind of job that was his, not even how well are you doing the job, but crying.
I think often people in those positions get nothing but an expression of envy from the pastor.
Yeah,
it's very peculiar. But I think about that congregation where Ron was talking about the men's retreat, and I think so often the pastors that were there tended to look at those men with jealousy because they had money and they had power.
Mm-hmm.
And certainly they didn't receive an expression of compassion.
Yeah.
Yeah, and her uncle happens to be a very wealthy farmer in North Dakota, 30 miles outside of Fargo. And we visited him once this summer. And he said exactly this thing that you're talking about.
Mm-hmm.
He says, we have a pastor, yet why can't a pastor understand that we have to be ministered to? Just because we're successful,
mm-hmm.
if things seem to be going well, they leave us alone. He says, we want somebody to come out and admit it. We have a lot on our mind.
Mm-hmm.
And her uncle is very mindful of all of these things.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he's very...
Very responsible Christian.
Yeah. Since he's a missionary, and he's going to go into it, I think, once he
passes the
far
farm.
I think that's...
Yeah.
It's a heavy responsibility.
I agree. I like Charlie Carroll, one of my friends who grew up as a Catholic and money and became a Protestant, said, Al, why are the Lutherans so afraid of mink coats and leather jackets?
That's good. That's good.
A second session on the ALC Manifesto begins with a discussion of the Russian author Solzhenitsyn. On this tape, we have included the first part of this session.
Letter to the Soviet Leaders by Solzhenitsyn, who pleads with them to drop their ideology that he believes has imprisoned them, makes it impossible for them to do anything, and drains off all their energies on international fronts, and allowing their own country to deteriorate. It's a beautiful. Now he's saying he fears war between China and Russia, but not between China, or not between the United States and China, or Russia. This he doesn't think. He even says he doesn't think there'll be a nuclear war, because that after World War I, when chemical warfare, gas, was used and could have continued to be used, that there's been no inclination to use it since, because it's too self-destructive. He thinks nuclear warfare too is out. And the war between China and Russia would be pretty much the traditional kind of warfare, with China winning.
Oh. How long ago was that?
Because of sheer numbers.
That was right when he was exiled, wasn't it, that he wrote that?
I suppose it was, however, 6 months, it was addressed to them 6 months before the archipelago was confiscated by them.
Mm-hmm. That was probably 2.5-3 years ago.
Well, what he describes happening to the villages and the countryside in Russia is somewhat parallel to what's happening in our country, and he accuses them of destroying the villages and destroying individualism of the small life by these vast collective farms and industrialization, and no attention paid to the individual.
You know, Muggeridge has a really interesting description of that from the outside, as a foreign correspondent in his autobiography, the first volume. Did you see that?
Yes, the green ears.
Yeah, the green stick.
Yeah, the green stick.
But that's kind of interesting, because he went to Russia as a foreign correspondent. He was ready to move there. And he was very disillusioned with the English system. And he moved, and he went there. And within a few months, you know, he just couldn't believe it. And that, so he wrote back to England these articles, and nobody would believe him. And nobody would believe what he saw. Then when he went back there too, nobody would believe it.
What did you see that he
was because it wasn't as rosy a picture as they anticipated it would be?
Yeah, well, just the confiscation of the land, the way that the way the peasants were starving, you know, just vast areas of land gone to waste. It had been prosperous, growing area.
Stuff he told me to wait and silver to everything else.
Just the repression of individual freedom.
I figured that would take me half an hour.
And of course, this was when they were still seeing the Soviet Union as a kind of a hope for the Western world, sort of a pioneering socialist state.
I hear a lot of people talking about China that way now, and it's always interesting the people who talk about it that way. I have an uncle who's a sociology professor, and another uncle who's also in sociology. And they both have very fine, expensive homes, and you know all the traffics that go along with that. And they talk about China as if that were just, you know, a wonderful place to live.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, well, sure, while you're sitting there in your comfortable home, seems like it would be real rosy. But would you really give all those things up? I don't know.
Mm-hmm. There aren't many people having gone abroad. That is, as Americans, having grown up here and gone abroad, who aren't willing to come back and live, despite the criticisms that are levied against our way of life. He pleads also for, you know, he says that, I don't think Russia is ready for a democracy a democratic order. The authoritarianism that was the Tsar's, and the authoritarianism that now is with the Soviets or with the communists, will simply have to continue. But he pleads for them to relax their persecution of the of freedom of speech and freedom of worship, and let the Soviets or let the Marxists have free rein as far as promulgating their ideas, but don't let them do that with state money. Dissociate yourself from this propaganda business and let them have all the freedom they want, but also give the same freedom to other groups, including, he says, the church. Because he said, authoritarianism or autocracy of some kind or another can still allow for constitutions and laws and freedom, a certain amount of freedom. He speaks a little with some disdain about the United States should we argue in all sincerity that we're not adherents of that turbulent democracy run riot in which once every 4 years the politicians and indeed the entire country nearly kill themselves over an electoral campaign trying to gratify the masses. So he's not saying we ought to be like the United States. We need more order than that. But he pleads for the restoration, and he said the old authoritarianism under the Tsars, at least earlier, had a moral quality. You know, you ruled under God. Kind of, the note of the transcendent was there for the ruler, too. And this ancient, 7 centuries old orthodoxy, which gave strong moral foundation to many convinced that, what did he say, I myself see Christianity today as the only living spiritual force capable of undertaking the spiritual healing of Russia.
Could you read that again, please?
Yeah. I myself see Christianity today as the only living spiritual force capable of undertaking the spiritual healing of Russia. But I request and propose no special privileges for it, simply that it should be treated fairly and not suppressed. Allow us a free art and literature, the free publication, not just of political books, God preserve us, and exhortations and election leaflets. Allow us something else. Allow us philosophical, ethical, economic, and social studies, and you'll see what a rich harvest it brings and how it bears fruits for the good of Russia. Such an abundant and free-flowing flowering of inspiration will rapidly absolve us of the need to keep on belatedly translating new ideas from Western languages, as has been the case for the whole of the last 50 years, as you know. Well, that isn't what we're going to talk about. We're going to talk about us. Our convention, the American Lutheran Church, will meet in Washington in October. And there was a reason for doing that, hoping that probably the church itself would become more aware of its responsibilities to the state or to the society, to the nation and the world. And then perhaps also that a document from the American Lutheran Church might, by the respective candidates, get some attention on the respective parties, and hope that the two candidates, whoever they be, will maybe address the convention at some time or another, or appear for the convention. So the document may get some attention beyond the church, beyond our own congregations at this point, but the desire was to have it get attention by the congregations and not just at some peak point where the newspapers would pick it up for a day, and then it's all forgotten. And so the commission working at this had hoped, and in many parts of the church, it is being discussed, and groups are talking about it and sending in recommendations or suggestions or corrections or whatever to the commission that meets again in August. This note of repentance, I should say, did not find all enthusiastic response. And I suppose had we not had two blacks and an American Indian and a Latin American in the group, this wouldn't have surfaced quite as much. But it surfaced, and I think rightly so. But a lot of people say, well, why? I haven't been consciously guilty of doing this. Or if I have been guilty, am guilty, how am I going to change? What can I do in the struggle for justice and liberation and peace that I haven't done?